Case number 13-1593, Ronnie Foote, Appellant v. Ernest Moniz, Secretary of Energy. Mr. Foote for the Appellant, Mr. Scarborough for the Appellant.
Mr. Foote?
Your Honors, thank you for your time today. I'd like to cover four crucial points to guide you to a correct understanding regarding my appeals, then conclude. First and foremost, it saddens me that I lost both my EEO discrimination complaint and the district court civil complaint because the Department of Energy withheld evidence plus submitted to the court an altered official document. Point two, the agency intentionally withheld my HRP records until after I filed my opposition to the defendant's motion for judgment on the pleading. September 8th, 2012, I filed my motion for judgment on the pleading. Excuse me, let me. September 8th, 2012, I filed my opposition to the defendant's motion for judgment on the pleading. 11 days later, they sent me my HRP file. Point number three. The opinion written by Honorable Justice Cotella was in error. It stated the court could entertain a procedural claim, but no such claim is alleged in this case and ruled against me. This was a court oversight because I did state on my initial pleading that the Department of Energy did not follow applicable policy, procedures, and regulations in evaluating Mr. Foote's eligibility for HRP certification. My fourth point, I have submitted to this court key material from my HRP file showing that an official document was altered and submitted by appellee. Now appellee is asking this court to strike that material. Today, today is only fair that this court accepts my evidence of wrongdoing by the agency because they were withholding my file from me since the beginning, 2007. My case has strong merits with cat's paw theory of liability, which holds the Secretary of Energy accountable for his employees who report falsely to a decision maker, resulting in an adverse employment action, a violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I beg this court to please deny their motion to strike my evidence, reverse the district court judgment and rule in my favor, award me damages for discrimination and my ruined professional reputation. This is the correct thing to do. I thank you. The remainder of my time, I would like to reserve for rebuttal if needed.
Might I ask you one question before you sit down?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell us a little bit about the job that you were seeking in Albuquerque? What was the nature of that? I mean, this may be outside what we can consider because we're under 12C, we're looking at the pleadings. But just for our understanding about what was the job and how did it in particular interact with the nuclear material that's situated at Albuquerque?
Okay, ma'am, the job that I was seeking in Albuquerque, New Mexico, was the exact same job that I worked in Albuquerque, New Mexico 2 years prior. I worked the exact same job. I got offered a job in headquarters. I went to headquarters, and then I wanted to go back to Albuquerque, so I was seeking the exact same job, which is an emergency operations specialist. It's similar to working inside of a police dispatch control center. It's a control center. And I deal with this like a control center, answering phones and working with classified computers and equipment only. I have no access to any nuclear material, weapons, whatsoever. It's in a control center, and it's just classified computers.
Did you say classified computers?
Yes, sir.
Meaning that the computers have classified information in them?
Yes, sir.
And what is the control center controlling? Is it controlling movements around the nuclear material, or?
Yes, ma'am. It's TECC, ma'am, stands for Transportation Emergency Control Center. And we do have, the United States have convoys of vehicles carrying weapons throughout the United States. And part of the control center is to monitor, one portion of our job is to monitor vehicles while they're on the road in case there's an accident or bad weather, and we need to alert the vehicle drivers of conditions so we kind of keep track of where they are in case something is they need to know about.
Thank you, Mr. Foote.
You're welcome. Thank you, sir.
We'll give you some time for rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Scarborough.
May it please the Court, Charles Scarborough, Department of Justice for the Secretary of Energy. With me at the council table is Jonathan Buckner from the National Nuclear Security Administration in New Mexico. The district court in this case correctly held that certification under the Department of Energy's Human Reliability Program, or HRP, is the functional equivalent of a security clearance, and that plaintiff's challenge to the denial of HRP certification was therefore non-justiciable under EGAN. Predictive judgments about whether a person can safely be allowed access to dangerous nuclear materials are at least as sensitive and committed to executive branch discretion as predictive judgments about whether a person can safely be allowed access to classified information.
That can't just be any predictive judgment, right? After Radigan, it has to be predictive judgment by someone who's involved in the decision-making process, or where would you draw the line there?
Well, it's not entirely clear what the scope of Radigan going forward is. As Your Honor is well knows, we disagree with Radigan. We recognize that it's the law of the circuit. We think that under the Radigan rubric here, what you have are predictive judgments by trained adjudicated personnel here, the psychologists who are charged under the regulations with making these evaluations here. There's no indication that, you know, there's people, it's just sort of people on the street who are not trained in that. So we think we fall within the heartland of what Radigan says is protected here. And I should emphasize that, you know, we've used the metaphor of super security clearance here. That is just that, a metaphor. It's basically that, you know, there's a security clearance component to the HRP certification. That's sort of point one, the basic threshold. And then you need to meet. That's right. That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you. And then there's a whole list of additional requirements that you have to meet, and one of them is a more searching inquiry into your psychological, safety and reliability.
Why not treat Dr. Seagraves here like the other FBI employees in Radigan? In other words, Dr. Seagraves is not making the final decision.
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is Dr. Seagrave is specifically designated as one of the trained adjudicated personnel, and in addition, you have then an HRP certified.
But makes
official.
The report to someone else who makes the final decision.
I thought it was Dennis Reese was the trained adjudicated personnel.
And Dennis Reese made the decision not to give HRP certification. That's another distinguishing characteristic from Radigan, which was a highly unusual case, as you know, in which the people who were the trained adjudicated personnel said, no, actually, you're okay. We're going to let you keep your security clearance. So there's sort of multiple ways in which this case is different from Radigan, yet at the same time falls within the heartland of what even Radigan recognized is protected under EGAN.
Mr. Scarborough, what if a... I'm sorry, go ahead. What if you have somebody administering lie detector tests, and they're an expert person, expert in the administration of lie detectors, but they are biased and decide that they will falsely, intentionally and falsely report that all the African-American applicants have failed their test, and they report that to the HRP certifying official or to the adjudicative official. Is there under Rattigan a claim or not?
I don't think there is a claim under Rattigan. I mean, I think that if ultimately what results is the denial of a security clearance, I don't think Rattigan stands for the proposition that
I'm
you
saying
could...
denial of an HRP. I mean, because the lie detector is not, in fact, a separate requirement of HRP certification. It's a requirement of security clearance. But if it were...
I'm sorry, which hypothetical? I mean, my answer is going to be the same for both.
That's helpful.
Right.
I'm asking you about the elements that go into the HRP process, because we know that the security clearance process is covered by EGAN.
That's right.
But I'm trying to understand the extent to which you're asking us to expand that. And so I'm imagining a situation in which one of the inputs in the HRP process is something that's conducted by an expert professional who's trained and who's specified as part of the process, but who falsely and intentionally gives biased information to the HRP certifying official. Is that a case in which the plaintiff could go forward or not, and if not, why not?
No, it could not go forward in that case, and for the same premise that you started with, that it couldn't go forward in the EGAN in the security clearance context. EGAN recognizes there's the same potential always for abuse. When you're dealing with a non-reviewability situation, you always can, you know, postulate situations in which there might be abuse here. Obviously, the agencies that, you know, are involved here have every reason to police that sort of abuse because they're dealing, they want to get accurate information, they want to make judgments under the executive order, you know, that are clearly about whether people can be allowed access to things that are clearly consistent with the national security. So my answer is the same, and just the fact that, you know, there are additional inputs here as part of the HRP process does not change the answer.
Counsel,
yes?
I mean, the additional inputs, I think, is important, potentially important. There's the requirement of the Q authorization, and in your brief, you made that a part, at least as I understood it, of a claim that this is a security decision of the sort protected by EGA. Right. But that's 11A1, and then we go on to various things, including 7, psychological evaluation, test plus semi-structured interview. If the Q clearance is the core security decision, you can't get that unless you meet security requirements, then at least a possible inference would be that the requirement in subsection 7 is something extra, is something not related, at least not directly related to security, but is more, is more related to a good candidate for the job.
I don't think you can unpack the security concerns and sort of say that all the security concerns are dealt with in the Q clearance situation here. I mean, the whole package that you're dealing with here, what you're ultimately trying to decide is whether someone can safely be allowed access to nuclear materials. That is clearly sort of the large package of HRP certification is clearly a security concern. I would refer, Your Honor, to the Reg 712.14, that's at 362. In our addendum here, at least that's where it begins, which talks about the purpose of the medical assessment. And if I may, I would like to just read what that is. The HRP medical assessment is performed to evaluate whether an HRP candidate or an HRP certified individual, one, represents a security concern, or two, has a condition that may prevent the individual from performing HRP duties in a safe and reliable manner. So while Your Honor is correct that there's sort of a threshold determination that's made with the Q security clearance, there are a whole bunch of additional things, including the medical assessment. I don't think we can sort of dismiss that as something other than a security concern. It would be sort of analogous to saying that, you know, because someone can be allowed access, the executive branch has made a determination that someone can be allowed access to secret, you know, given a secret clearance, that the determination that they can't be allowed, say, top secret, you know, is in some way then reviewable. I mean, it's an extra level, and that's why we use the metaphor of super security clearance.
Right. You're using that metaphor, but isn't it critical under Egan and under our precedents that there be clear statutory and executive authorization for such a program, and that the statutory and executive authorization for your program is?
It is Executive Order 10-450. I mean, that's cited in the authority section there. It's also, there's a bunch of other things cited there, too, but that's the primary thing. That's the executive order that Egan itself relied on, which, you know, imposes upon executive branch agencies the duty to make decisions whether access to various things is clearly consistent with national security. It's not limited to classified information. It really bears noting that's the main way in which sort of these Egan cases have gone forward. They often involve classified information, but the what the executive order talks about is clearly consistent with the interest of national security, and we think that is really plainly encompasses access to nuclear materials, which of course includes a subset of determinations about access to classified materials. So that's why we think the super security clearance metaphor is really apt.
And under our precedents, any constitutional claim arising out of this employment would be able to go forward.
I don't think any constitutional claim. I think what your precedents make clear, Greenberg and Harmon in particular, is a constitutional challenge to the policies. I'm not sure a challenge to sort of how the agency acted, you know, within the framework would be allowed to go forward. I think that's a little less clear. And there and the fact that it's a constitutional claim, I don't think makes too much of a difference. I mean, the El-Ghanani case in the Third Circuit stands for that proposition, and some other cases as well. There is, I do want to acknowledge, there is room for a challenge to sort of the policies, the scheme as a whole, as it's set up, that, you know, it's unconstitutional in some way. But there is no such challenge brought in this case, and the district court expressly so held.
And Egan and these cases, Rattigan, to the extent it bars Title VII suits or similar suits, Congress can change that.
I think that generally speaking, we think that's possible. I think that would present a difficult question. There's some scattered decisions out there that refer to the difficulty of the question that might be presented because Egan does rest on separation of powers concerns. So it's not something that I'm prepared to concede right now.
Although
but
I do say, I think, unless Congress says otherwise in Egan, and so that's at least a hint that they weren't making this in an area of exclusive executive constitutional authority, but rather in the absence of Congress saying otherwise, the executive would be able to do this.
And certainly Congress has spoken in some respects in the Title VII. There's a specific exemption under Title VII for national security concerns and things. So there are ways in which Congress has dealt with this issue. But my main point is that that hasn't prevented courts from applying Egan principles in a variety of contexts to say, no, there's actually a bar here. And that's what I would emphasize, is that often in these cases, there's sort of a reaction of, well, what's the harm? We could review this and, you know, we could review it deferentially. And the harm ultimately is that it might not be reviewed deferentially, and that's not what Egan did. Egan didn't say, you know, okay, well, we'll look at your security-based reasons here with a deferential thing. It said no review at all. And this court's decisions, Ryan, Bennett, even Rattigan, recognized that there is an absolute bar when you're dealing with the trained officials designated to make security-related decisions.
Didn't you overstate a little bit when you said there's an exemption from Title VII for national security?
I may have, Your Honor. What I was referring to is 42 U.S.C. 2000E2G, which is a provision that basically relates to national security interests and exempts employer actions discharging employees from positions on national security grounds. It takes that out. It says that that's okay.
You can discharge on that ground, but if, for example, a security clearance were denied for discriminatory reasons it wasn't until that predates Egan, and it wasn't until Egan that it was thought there was any kind of exception, and that really relies on the trumping executive power, not on some limitation that Congress enacted in Title VII.
That's correct, Your Honor. I probably have just put my foot in a bad place by even bringing up that exemption. I was trying to respond to Judge Kavanaugh's question about Congress being able to put limits on these issues. And I was trying to acknowledge that might be possible, but there might also be separation of powers concerns depending upon, you know, what was done.
Just in response to your characterization of the preservation of constitutional claims notwithstanding Egan, as I read our precedents, for example, United States Information Agency versus Kirk, KRC, there was a remand of equal protection claims that were individual claims arising out of a Foreign Service Act dismissal. And so I think the authorities, at least in our circuit, don't foreclose the notion that an individual could have an equal protection claim arising out of employment and continue to pursue that.
As you know, this case, the briefing has not focused on that because it's really not a part of this case. And I'm sorry if I overstated. I don't want to take a firm position on what the government's position might be. Often what I'm trying to suggest is that a challenge to policies, a putative challenge to policies, really is, in effect, a challenge to the executive branch's, you know, actual decision here. And what we would, you know, come into court and say is that's barred by Egan. It's sort of the challenge to the policies in the abstract that I think we acknowledge can go forward.
I'm just trying to explore, you know, because we do have a pro se litigant, the allegations of the complaint alleging intentional racial discrimination might be viewed as alleging an equal protection violation. Now, I know that this hasn't been briefed, but the Supreme Court has some, you know, Bivens cases that say, well, where there's a Title VII remedy, we don't allow equal protection challenge because the more elaborate statutory scheme encompasses them. But where that's been shunted aside by our precedents under Egan, there is no Title VII claim available in this circuit if indeed you're right that this is within Egan. I'm just trying to explore what the government's position is on the interplay between a potential equal protection claim, Title VII, and your assertions about the scope of Egan.
They're complicated questions, and as you pointed out, we filed a 20-page brief in this case that dealt with the issues that the district court addressed here, which, in our view, fall sort of within the heartland of what even Rattigan says is still preserved here. The question of equal protection claims and their interrelationship with Title VII, we could go on for an entire law school seminar about that sort of thing. So I'm not really prepared to take a position there, but we do think that this is a relatively simple application of Egan and this court's precedent in Rattigan. We'll close with sort of a final thought on Rattigan, since that casts a long shadow over these proceedings here, is that I think the concern there was that, and what drove the court, and I don't want to put thoughts into the court's mind, to carve out the knowing falsity exception for the security reporting concerns there, was the large number of employees who had access, the ability to report security concerns. You didn't want to expand Egan sort of too far. In this case, you sort of have the exact opposite. You have at the very top sort of a very limited universe of people who are doing essentially what we've characterized as a super security clearance determination involving something very, very important, access to nuclear materials that really sort of by definition with the ambit of clearly consistent with the national security.
Can I just press you a little on our earlier exchange? You, when I asked you about the relationship between subsection 1 and subsection 7, you drew the analogy between a secret clearance on a top secret clearance, and obviously that the clearance is top secret doesn't do anything to remove it from Egan. But what is it that is there something that assures us that subsection 7, for example, is ratcheting up the security requirement as opposed to an overlay that is not that closely related to security?
Well, the way I tried to allay Your Honor's concerns was by going to that provision.
The purpose, right.
The purpose, which expressly in the reg, refers to the purpose of the medical assessment as being a security concern in part. I mean, I think that what the basic point is that sort of you don't then, when you get to the extra level of HRP certification above and beyond the Q security clearance, there isn't a difference in kind in terms of what you were doing there. You're now sort of looking at the individual's safety and reliability, but that is all for purposes of making a determination whether allowing access is clearly consistent with the national security. You're doing a more searching psychological inquiry than you would otherwise be doing for the normal security clearance thing. So that's all I was trying to suggest is there's different levels for access to different things, and this is really sort of at the very pinnacle, and it's a relatively small universe. That's the point that I was trying to make about Rattigan, where there was a relatively large universe, and that was, I think, what was driving the court there to reach that result.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Scarborough.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Foote, do you want to take any time for rebuttal?
No, sir, I'm ready.
Okay, thank you very much. The case is submitted. Oh, you are going to take time for rebuttal. Yes, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. Please take time for rebuttal.
Talk funny, I'm from Cleveland, sir, my bad. The Department of Energy, Personal Security Division, have testified on my behalf with a sworn affidavit that the agency HRP management lied about derogatory information then submitted by Personal Security Division, and procedures were not followed by the agency in denying my HRP suitability determination. It was the Department of Energy's Personal Security Division decision to grant me my current top secret security clearance, plus their decision to favorably recommend me for HRP certification. These trained security division personnel decisions are banned on judicial review. This is according to Radigan versus Holder, July 2012. Department of Energy, Personal Security Division, they got my back on this one. That's all.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The case is submitted.